Jeez. We get started. It's about 5 after. So it looks like I'm leading this today. Good times. Don't take this as a sign that I'm willing to lead from here on out, because I don't know that I have the time to lead anybody. But welcome, everybody. Looks like we don't have anybody here from the public today. So we need to, has everyone had a chance to review the March minutes? We have a motion to approve those minutes. We have a second. Any discussion? Okay. All in favor to approve the March minutes? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing no one else? No. That motion carries. Let's hand it over to Commissioner Chavez-Houck on the census update.
So a couple of things. Do we have people? Are we recording or we need the mic?
Yeah.
Okay, so I just want to make sure that the mic's picking me up. So I'm sure you've probably seen a lot in the press lately related to concerns with the fact that the Census Bureau has opted to include a citizenship question in the census. So I wanted to kind of bring that to the Commission's attention as an area of concern as we prepare as a community to support the administration as it conducts the census here in Salt Lake City and in the state. I wanted to chat about it prior to the fact that that decision had been brought forth. I have been concerned probably for at least the last 6 to 7 months or so, was brought to my attention actually at the Governor's Multicultural Commission Vice Chair Byron Russell brought it to the commission's concern, primarily focused on the fact that both the administration and Congress have opted to, at that point, fund the implementation of the census at the same funding levels that were done in 2010 for the 2010 census. So both Congress and the administration said, we're going to do the census and we're going to do it at the same, using the same resources basically that we did in 2010. So not allowing for, of course, an increased number of individuals. The other thing that they have moved towards doing is an intention to primarily conduct the census using online methods and via the internet and online, doing electronic means versus what we know to be so necessary in our marginalized and in our rural communities, which is person-to-person enumeration. So we had a discussion at the Governor's Multicultural Commission in that regard back last fall. It was my understanding also at that point that Salt Lake County was starting to look at what do they need to be doing in terms of assuring that people are counted effectively and as thoroughly as possible. After that, I had the opportunity to go to the National Conference of State Legislatures conference, Fall Summit in San Diego in December, where it was also a topic of great concern for all of the legislators and the staff and the others that were there to talk about what can we do if the administration of Congress refuses to implement a rigorous, thorough, and accurate census in 2020, what can we be doing as localities, as local officials, to do as much as we can to ensure that people are counted? So two things from that. I was getting very frustrated because I had not heard that the government, I hadn't heard if there had been a complete count committee that was convened at the state level. So if you're not familiar with the way the census is implemented, that each community puts together what's called a complete count committee, and they try to pull as many stakeholders as possible around the table to talk about how they're going to assist the administration, the feds, to implement the census. And here we are 2 years out from the census beginning, and I wasn't hearing about what was happening. I talked to a couple of people who are somewhat associated with this issue, and they relayed to me that the governor's office in particular was really downplaying the importance of implementing an effective census primarily because they didn't see that we were going to be getting an additional congressional seat. So it's like, since we're not going to have enough of an increase in population to afford us another congressional seat, this really isn't as important as others may think it is.
Right.
It is. And so, I mean, and that's kind of where my brain went is I'm thinking, why? Right. Number one, it's required by the Constitution. And what they'll say to answer that is that, yes, you know, it's going to be implemented, but this lack of concern of the effectiveness, right, and the accuracy and trying new systems, this whole notion of doing everything or primarily using the internet and online, given what we've been dealing with in terms of cybersecurity with elections and other issues, I just felt the blinders were on big time. And so, you know, a number of states have stepped forward with trying to, California in particular has done a really wonderful job in terms of developing their own very rigorous complete count committee. I felt like the little boy in Peter that calls wolf and just trying to get people's attention. And so what I finally did is I just took it in my own hands in terms of this whole, at the state level, drafted a resolution for the legislative session, contacted Senator Kevin Van Tassel, who's a senator from the Uinta Basin area, showed him, and I'll hand this out to you in a minute, there's a website called HTC Hard to Count 2020. And what you can do is you can drill down on neighborhoods and on the states and neighborhoods to see which neighborhoods and communities in your state, county, and city will have a high likelihood of being undercounted based on what happened in 2010. Mm-hmm. So I showed that to Senator Van Tassel, and I said, your district is bright red, sir. Mm-hmm. You've got so many communities in your district that are going to likely be undercounted. Will you join me in authoring an op-ed for the Tribune? So we did the op-ed. Then I put together the resolution. He was kind enough to be my Senate sponsor. But I just wanted to bring some public awareness to this issue that people just don't seem to care about in general. And at least some people in authority, I guess, is what I would, where I would put the concern. So at the same time, I had reached out to Jennifer Selig here at the city. She had been in conversation with Karen Hale at the county. So there were things that were starting to happen with some of the localities of what's happening. Why aren't we hearing about the governor convening a complete count committee? We're way behind in terms of getting that put together. Things that have not happened at the national front that, again, some additional concern needs to be expressed is that the president has not appointed a director for the census. The director last summer that was the former director of the census resigned in June. Oh. He put forth an individual that had no demographic experience. The fellow had written a book. He was a professor in a Texas university professor who actually ascribes to the philosophy that gerrymandering is a good thing. And was really focused kind of on this whole apportionment issue, not even looking at all of these other issues that affect decennial census in terms of the funding that we get and all of that from the federal government. And so there was great concern about this individual possibly being the Census Bureau chief when he had no experience other than the fact that he was an academic, which academics are great, but in terms of managing the 2020 census, the decennial census, counting every individual in this country, different skill set completely. So fast forward to January, and that individual pulled his name out of the running. So there is no census director as we speak right now. I think that they've got an interim that has been appointed, and they're still looking for an individual. 2 years out, we have no census director at the federal level. So what I think needs to happen at this point is that localities need to take this, at least prepare for making sure people are counted as best we can, and to engage in collaborative efforts with other jurisdictions. To make sure that addresses are accurate, because that's part of what's happening right now is that each community has to send data sheets to the feds of these are the addresses that we have information about. We need to, obviously, the communities that are often undercounted, like I mentioned, are marginalized communities, persons with disabilities, the seniors of people in the rural areas. Rural areas maybe are not as much of a concern for us, but the other communities are the ones that I think that we as Salt Lake City need to take a step forward and be proactive in preparing to help our community be counted effectively. And so last week, as things happen so fast, last week, Jennifer Seelig, Karen Hale, Carlton Christensen, also with the county, our GIS person here at the city, Mike Reberg, and three individuals from the governor's office, including his planner. Oh, that's the other thing, too. We have one planner with the state that's been funded to help with all of this at the state level. Got together. They're starting to now convene a complete count committee. I provided recommendations because when I was looking at the list,
the county that's doing the complete count.
It's going to be the state is finally convening a complete count committee, and they pulled the three of us together. They, you know, people that I saw missing from that list were somebody from the Disability Law Center. They had a number of refugee communities, which were great represented, but not very many from the Latino community and not very many from the Native American community. So we were all just trying to throw names of there's other people that didn't need to be at this table as we move forward. The library system, you know, we were just trying to think who's missing. So we're currently advising and giving counsel to the governor's complete count committee of who should be at that table. I will be on, I've been invited to help out with that. So I just wanted to let you all know that I will provide monthly reports as to what things are happening and how we can move forward as a city to at least make sure our people, every single one of them, is counted in 2020. So, and I'll just continue to keep you apprised on that.
Is there anything that we can do now to recommend to the mayor or to the city council at this point?
Possibly what we could review. What we may want to do is take a look at how other localities are stepping forward to plan ahead. Are they engaging in setting aside resources and staff to do their own counts? I don't know. I think what might be helpful, Moana, is if you talked to Jennifer Seelig, as well as the GIS and the fellow, and I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, and just find out where we can be most helpful in regards to the city moving forward. In my head, immediately, I go to resources and staff, because if the state isn't going to do a good job, we may need to set aside our own funding with the city going into 2019 and 2020, whether it's in terms of outreach, whether it's in terms of I don't know, but I think that we, that localities need to step forward if the state isn't going to, because we didn't put any money towards it over and above what's already put into the planning office for the state. And that is very disconcerting. And so I think what needs to happen at the local levels is each of our communities needs to be ready to take care of our own, if nothing else, and then make sure that's communicated to the Census Bureau as that moves forward. So.
And do we have any information, and I realize sometimes we don't know what we don't know,
right,
but do we have any information on any of the gaps that may have occurred previously that were later identified so we can, you know.
What we may want to do, again, is maybe see if the GIS person or somebody with, see if maybe he could come and give a report of what happened in the past. I know that, I remember I was working with Pam Perlick at the time after 2010, and I'm trying to remember what issue she brought up. Of that there was, in her mind, the numbers that were validated numbers from the Census Bureau didn't match what she knew to be true in terms of the numbers of individuals that live in Salt Lake City. So she felt that we were undercounted last time. I cannot recollect the reason why we were undercounted, but I do remember that we were undercounted. And she was gravely concerned because she says, you know, this has to do with funding. She says the city is not going to get what they need in terms of transportation and all the rest of the funding that we get, school lunch. So many things are dependent. I'll give you another. There's a list that George Washington University, their policy is to Institute put together in terms of all of the different funding streams that are dependent on the accurate decennial census count and how much Utah gets, and it's about $1,000 per capita here in Utah. Utah gets one of the lowest amounts
that's
not very much compared to other states, which is why that is even giving me graver concern that we are not going to do a good count. But I think that would be helpful maybe to have somebody from the mayor's office do a presentation of what happened in 2010 mm-hmm. and an analysis of the communities that were undercounted and how that may have affected us going forward in terms of being able to provide for the members of our community. So I think that would be one of the first things that I would think we need to do is get a snapshot of what happened last time, where he sees the weak points being going forward, and then we can start brainstorming some recommendations, and then I'll see what's happening at the state level and bring that to the table as we move forward, as well as nationally. The National Caucus of Hispanic State Legislators, we issued a release last week on this. I passed a resolution with that body bringing to attention the concern with not having a good census. Naleo and a number of other Latino-oriented organizations are also stepping forward as a collective, saying we need to make sure we're not undercounted. And so maybe we could also possibly research which the other groups have called to account and maybe start to gather what some ideas that they're doing. But it would be interesting to see what some of their cities are doing so that we're not reinventing the wheel, and where they seem to be successful in implementing new strategies that we just maybe adopt those, because we don't have a lot of time. We've got less than a year, really.
I think realistically it is less than a year that we'd have.
If I can ask a question really quickly. So with California, New York, and some other states considering filing a lawsuit with the federal government, the census risks becoming a political issue. Mm-hmm. How are the city and the state of Utah going to be on the same page on that issue, or are we going to risk having a division where we're going to have a position as a city that is going to be in opposition to what the state takes on the?
And I think as we see with what rigor the state steps forward, we might need to be prepared to distinguish ourselves. Mm-hmm. I would be surprised if we are totally on the same page. There may be issues where there's some commonality. I'm not seeing the energy and the enthusiasm that I would hope to see from the state in moving forward either. I don't think we're going to align ourselves with the lawsuit, even though I'm going to bring that up at the first complete count committee on April the 16th. Especially, again, when they keep talking about apportionment and aren't even thinking about these other issues related to it.
Since money is involved, it might sway them a little bit more that we want to count our everybody here.
That's what I've tried to emphasize. There's a crisis of conscience in a way with some of my colleagues and those that are more conservative related to this, because they don't want the way they view the federal government and having to depend on the federal government to provide funding is causing them conflict. In some ways, they're like, well, we should just be able to do all of this stuff ourselves, and we shouldn't have to worry about counting in the first place. So just understand that that's kind of an interesting overlay on that, as you well know. And I think that really does speak to what you started your comments with, which this is going to turn into a political football. And the citizenship question was precisely put out there to amplify it as a political issue versus focusing on what the impact is to our community in a negative way. And why would we bring back a question that really didn't have a purpose in the first place? I'm getting all sorts of great emails since we ran our press release. With people just completely blind to the fact that individuals are going to be in our community regardless of the count them or not. And so we either know they're there and know how to work with them, or I don't know. It's just very frustrating. So I'm just going to hand out, this is, let me copy this. This is the census hard to count maps. So that'll take you to the website, and you can just do that on your own. But it's fun to drill down into your neighborhood and neighborhoods, or look at the neighborhoods of the city, because you can see where we'll have where you have individuals that where there's a likely to be an undercount. What it is, it's based on what happened last time. They look at what happened last time, and.
I have a question when you're done.
And then this is just a second thing. This is my resolution, just so that you have a copy of it. And this is what we passed in the state legislature.
Nice.
So I know you mentioned, like, we might have to do our own work with our communities. Is there some form of education on what the census is? Because I think that would be a great point to start out, especially with refugees and immigrants. Mm-hmm. A lot of time they have no idea what these forms are and why they have to tell all the individuals that are staying, and a lot of them are, you know, they're having to stay with single, with extra family members, mm-hmm. and they think they might lose their government support or schooling. And so how do we sort of put together an education piece up front?
And thank you for mentioning that, because I have fielded that question many times in the past where people, it terrifies them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Regardless of their legal status, mm-hmm. it absolutely terrifies them.
Right.
So putting something together for our community is, I think, really important.
Yeah, I think that would be a good idea. So since we're actually very new to this whole process, how do we make a recommendation to the mayor and to the council? Is there a formal recommendation process that we go through, or do we just say, hey, guys, you get on that? Because I know with some of my committees, there's a formal recommendation process, and there's, like, a time frame for the government to reply and
from what we reviewed last week with our both of the ordinances, there isn't really, it's kind of this nebulous thing where you, and there's a, the only requirement they have is that you have an annual report to the mayor and the city council. Okay. But in terms of giving updates, you can have as many or not as many as you want.
Sure.
So I think the letter, I know that Jason has some institutional knowledge, what they've done in the past, but
the
recommendation piece would be great if you are going to give that to her in the next
weeks. So when the committee is on good speaking terms with the mayor, it works really well just to talk to her or anybody from the staff, and it informally gets to them. Okay. When there has not been a good relationship, the chair would get the committee to draft a letter and send the letter so it's on the public record.
Gotcha.
So I'm not sure if one's a more formal process or informal process, but
I don't know what would be better for something like this, because it's kind of a lot of stuff that we're looking at that I think are all very good ideas that I think should be considered by both the mayor and our city council. So I don't know if it'd be better to just pull them aside and be like, hey, guys, this is what we want you to do, or if it would be better just because there's so much to put it into a formal email or letter or something mm-hmm. to that effect.
And then we'll relay that to her. And
right.
By email would probably be the first step, with a request to follow up in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
That's the best results I've had.
But also, if commissioners are interested in holding out, like, dialogues or events, I think in the past, depending on how active the commissioners want to be in their communities, I think
we're supportive
of that, and we could always, like, help with getting the venues. Like, we can use Sorensen Center, we can use the libraries. So we're here to sort of assist mm-hmm. with that, but we, like, really want to rely on your support.
And something along the lines of something like this census, I mean, this is something that needs to be repeated. It's not just a one-time we hold a listening session or something.
No. This is going to be ongoing.
It's got to be ongoing to be able to capture everybody. And, of course, someone mm-hmm. can hear something once, and then it out of sight, out of mind happens.
Again, I think what I would like to see is, again, Juana, if the two of you could even just do some research on what some other cities are doing. So again, we're not starting from scratch, and if they have some great ideas, mm-hmm. then at the next meeting we can say, you know, we like strategy A, B, and C.
Okay.
Let's
mm-hmm.
figure out a way to calendar that out. And then in the meantime, send an email to the mayor and to the city council. But I think at some point we really do need to do a formal letter, just because it needs to, the severity of the issue, the seriousness of the issue, and the timeliness related to, we don't have a lot of time to get this in front of them.
Right.
And then once we have a strategy put together and maybe a calendaring of, okay, 18 months out, we're working ourselves backwards. This is what we feel needs to be done this summer. This is what we feel needs to be done this fall. This is what we feel needs to be up and going by next year. And then, you know, communicate that to our individual council members, each those of us that, you know, as we represent the different districts, saying this, know that this is something I'm going to bring to your attention as something that is paramount, and then send the letter both to the mayor and the city council, you know, maybe next month after we get some idea of maybe some of that. After I get back from the first complete count committee, so I have a better handle of what's happening. You know, after we get some ideas of what some other cities and communities are doing.
This is just a brainstorming idea. That is something to recommend to go in that letter, but literature to get posted at libraries, rec centers, something like that, that has just a brief bullet point of what the census is and what you expect. That's the place where, at least in Rose Park, that I see the most people who may not be familiar with it, you know, refugees use the computer system at the libraries almost exclusively. So
churches are willing to post that sort of thing.
I was just thinking first through the city infrastructure, you know, the libraries, the rec centers, the public spaces that are used frequently, maybe schools.
And then media like the Spanish language and other diverse media, to have the radio and all of that. We can start just featuring how some of the commissioners featured it with some of these radio programs to say we were letting people know that we want to make sure that you're not counted, and as we get in for more information, we can tell them exactly what that looks like.
I think that's a one sheet to be posted on bulletin boards and stuff.
Can I ask what, generally, when the city puts out things for the public, what languages are they available in?
We usually do them in English and sometimes Spanish. The hard part is it depends on what type of event. So then, and then she'll have things that's specifically geared to the refugee committee. Mm-hmm. But because Utah isn't required to translate any of their documents for government, it's kind of difficult because then you send out a flyer for something in a language, but then when the person comes there, it's not required to have a translator.
Right. Mm.
So that's the difficulty that we've found here, and that's maybe something that this commission can talk about, because I've that doesn't make any sense. Like, why would you? Yeah. So I think with that, what we would do and take on that responsibility with, if we do have an event that's specifically geared to this, and say it's held at the Sorensen or on the west side, and then we know that the population there speaks a lot of Spanish and other languages, then just making sure that for that specific event we're going to have people housed there to answer those types of questions.
Right.
So in general, there isn't any general rule, but we kind of take that on ourselves for each event.
I know they were looking into the language access, but I don't know whether or not we were able to implement it. That was one of the projects that Yolanda was working, at least with the police department, but I don't know if it's going to be a citywide thing. And I think the other thing, does the census come in just English, or is it English and Spanish and no other languages?
I got it in English in 2010. That's all I remember.
That's what I remember, too. No other,
Yeah.
And see, I think that that's part of the challenge, is since they're relying on electronic means. Before, they used to have enumerators, and if you knew you were going to send an enumerator into a population, a neighborhood where you had a certain, equip that person, you know, make sure that the person is either bilingual, or, you know, that you had people there that were assisting in that, that were navigators, so to speak. The fact that there, what they said in December, because the Census Bureau can present to the legislators, because we were all concerned about that whole thing. And they said, well, what we're going to do is, with the initial contact, it's going to be online. And then if people don't respond, then we'll send somebody out. But it, you know, I just, this is a new way of doing it. And they're so, one of the biggest problems is they're so late in implementing it, they haven't been able to test it. They were supposed to test this mechanism in West Virginia and rural areas of Washington State this last year, and they didn't do the test. Jeez. We don't know if it's going to work.
Just online, what about people who can't access, who don't have access to a computer?
So that's why they're saying they're revisiting whether what it's going to look like, but it's a mess.
It disproportionately affects poor minorities and refugees.
With the question,
10 years ago, I recall that one of the number one undercounted demographics were Native Americans. And
here's the other thing is, does anyone realize that you can kind of answer outside of that? Because I have my own personal protest with the census, and I did it in 2010 with the race question, because the race question always bothers me, and I purposely put Chicano on there. I didn't put white, Hispanic. I just put Chicano and just put multiracial.
I checked all of them.
See, and I don't know that people realize you can do your own little protest there, and I purposely plan on not answering that citizenship question. I just out of protest that I am not going to answer
and
that
question. And I think that's the education part.
Yeah, a lot of people are
I don't think they realize that. That. You can do that, because I'm not going to do it, and I don't care who comes to my door.
And I think it's our time to also, to also use that as an opportunity to educate about the importance of voting and civic engagement with the communities. Because a lot of time they think if I check this box that I'm a citizen or not a citizen, then I am giving up all my powers to the authority figures.
So yeah, maybe part of that education piece is to include in that you don't have to answer that question.
The big push, I think, on the federal level is saying that it won't be used against you. I'm just not confident
that
messaging.
That's why I'm going to join in my undocumented brothers and sisters of all nationalities and just not answer. Say, screw you hippies, I'm not doing it.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one.
Okay, so then Rebecca, we'll look forward to an update next month after you have your first complete count committee. We'll look at drafting a formal letter because of the seriousness of this issue, not based on any specific issues of communication with the council or the mayor, but because this is a very serious issue, and I agree with you that perhaps a formal letter may be best to outline some of the requests that we're looking at. Moana will look into what other cities are doing of similar sizes, and of course we could see what Portland's doing, and maybe Austin. They tend to do about the same things that we do. And see if we can get a GIS person from this, one of our city GIS people to come in and talk to us about some of the weak points from the 2010 census.
Great. I got those. Excellent.
And don't just wait a month. If you need help with anything, let us know.
Get the email chain going.
Reach out to us all by email.
Right.
And to have someone from GIS come in and speak to us, can we attempt to hope to shoot for the next meeting, the following meeting?
Maybe for the May meeting.
That would be great.
You want the May meeting? I'll ask him to come.
Yeah,
There's a few people on their team, so we should have somebody who's available.
And the main reason is because we need to prioritize what we can do, and based on what the weaknesses are, that'll help us strategize in terms of what type of community outreach we want to do and what we want to do in terms of moving this forward.
That sounds awesome. That's a good plan.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Commissioner Chavez-Hauck. Status update. This is where I take over for a little bit. So I met with the mayor, and I'm a little embarrassed that after I met with the mayor and with David Litvak, I got really, really, really busy at work and was not able to follow up with a lot of things. But a lot of what I felt like I had a very productive conversation with David Litvak and with the mayor about a lot of issues, things that were on the top of my personal list in joining the Human Rights Commission, and a couple things that the mayor reminded me of. As to Operation Rio Grande, David Litvak gave me some very good information on how that is being operated, and we discussed, I had a handout that he gave me, but I can't find it right now. His impression of how Operation Rio Grande has been going is he didn't feel like any of our community partners were having a lot of heartburn over it. But what I did say is we probably need to get some more feedback from people who were on the ground and who were actually experiencing it. And what I proposed is, and I believe I included Jason on this email, was that we should probably meet with maybe some of the social workers at St. Vincent's at the Road Home, because they do, talking to individual homeless people, you're going to get a very interesting perspective depending on the day, the time,
what month, you know, you're going to get a very interesting view of that, and maybe not a very holistic view. And so maybe the better people to talk to, and I found them to be very, very helpful in the past, are the caseworkers there. They're very approachable. They're very open to even just quick appointments. And I know that I reached out to Matt Minkovich at the Road Home to get his input on that, but I haven't heard back from him. And that's not uncommon for Matt. In working with him on other projects in the past, he can be a little difficult to reach. So I'm kind of tempted to just wander on down there and knock on his office door and say, hey, let's chat, because that's worked for me in the past, and I don't have any problems wandering into the Road Home and being like, hey, what's going on? Let's talk, Matt. So that may be something we look into, because I do want to make sure that the people who are actually experiencing Operation Rio Grande are not being discriminated against. Mm-hmm. And I know that was a big concern for this commission, and it's a big concern for me. It's the homeless population is one of my pet populations. So I think that's something we could look into, Jason, if you want to keep working on that with me, and make sure also I haven't heard anything from the Disability Law Center either about people with disabilities being adversely affected or disproportionately adversely affected by Rio Grande. So,
did David bring up anything about there's growing backlash coming out of, I know, Rose Park Community Council, Fair Park Community Council, Glendale Community Council. They're not liking the influx of the perceived influx of homeless population being pushed away from Rio Grande into neighborhoods. And I've been seeing a lot more vocal backlash on that issue. Businesses along North Temple, that kind of thing. So if you said that there's nobody experiencing heartburn, I'm surprised.
Well, I think what it is I think we all expected some of that to happen. I know when I first heard about it, of course, for me, my first instinct was prosecutors are talking to who without an attorney mm-hmm. present?
Yeah.
And that kind of spurred my defense feathers a bit. But when I talked to my LDA friends, my legal defender friends, they're like, no, someone was there and advising them of their rights, and that made me calm down a bit. But my second thought was, oh boy, this is going to push the population out further, and we're going to start seeing probably a ripple effect. So and maybe it's just me, but I was expecting a backlash, and I've seen them pop up in District 5 too. All of Herman Franks Park, we've seen definitely an influx. So when I say the community partners don't have any heartburn over it, I think what I should have said is that the people who are working on Operation Rio Grande, who have joined in working on Operation Rio Grande, haven't had any heartburn how it's happened. Some of the neighborhoods for sure are experiencing that. And I've heard that Sandy's been complaining about the influx as well, that they've seen some of that.
Right.
I mean, it's all over.
It is. So a couple of things I'd add to the discussion. Number one is my frustration at the state level with an overt focus on the criminal justice piece of it.
Yeah.
You know, the speaker came and asked for a ton of money to continue work on on Operation Rio Grande, ORG, in an effort to provide a state match to a DEA grant. So again, the focus is on arrests.
Right.
The focus is on that, and not helping people who are, many of whom may be struggling with substance abuse or maybe dealing with other mental illness issues.
Right.
And I am not totally convinced that, as much as they say that there's effort to provide the good case management, the casework for these individuals, that's really happening, because there is just such an overt focus on criminal justice on this. And so I think that continues to be my concern. And we kind of have to sit back and say, I mean, at the state level, it's like, well, we're going to give the money, but this is what we want the money to go to. And for those of us that are in the minority that really can't drive the car, so to speak, we're like, okay, well, do we not support giving money to helping the process if there are some people that, I mean, if they truly are, if there truly is a criminal element and you want to deal with it, yeah, that's fine. But can't we figure out some way to put more money towards case management? And if we're going to do housing, to make sure it's wraparound and transitional supportive housing and permanent supportive housing for some of these individuals, instead of just making it cash cow for some developers to be able to do low-income housing. So I don't know. I have yet to be convinced that the state's focus is where it needs to be. It's not.
And
so
that's the impression I got from Mr. Litvak, is that it has, one of the downsides is it has become more focused on the policing and the arrests. And that was one of my regrets about it too, because my hope was that it would be more about case management, helping people with mental health issues access the services they need and not just filling beds at the ADC. So what my impression is that there were assurances that piece would be provided, and through whatever mechanisms were beyond many people's control, that piece was not implemented when it was supposed to be implemented. And of course, funding is always an issue, and we all know kids, criminals, and the mental health issues are very rarely funded where they need to be. Almost never, unless you have a massive lawsuit going. You won't get the funding that you need. And even then, you may get it, and it's going to be very reluctant, and it's going to be just a little bit less than what you need it to be.
And another thing that I'll just let you know that frustrated me with, and I brought this up to the mayor's, to Noella at the mayor's office, mm-hmm. Who's working on some of these homeless issues. At the Capitol, they brought up a few of the individuals with whom they had been working. They got them cleaned up. They put them in suits. They've started their treatment plans and their work plans. And to be quite honest with you, they carted them out. And I told Noella, I said, this really, I am uncomfortable with you bringing people out who are in treatment.
Right.
And I mean, I don't know how else to put it, but it was window dressing for something that I don't think has really reached success yet. I don't think that they should be saying, you know, checking the box, saying that the concern has been addressed. And she says, well, these individuals agreed to do it. And I said, I get that. But people who are just beginning their treatment program, they're in that honeymoon period of, yeah. You know, yeah, I'm doing great and I'm so excited. And I felt so uncomfortable with it. And I said, please, please be careful with how you utilize individuals' personal stories to garner favor with legislators and other people who are decision makers. I found it offensive, and I let them know it, because it bothered me immensely. And I bring that up only because I think that our commission is one of those types of entities that can really be the conscience of situations like this, to not get caught up in the press and the excitement of quote unquote having solved the homelessness problem, as it has been portrayed. So, you know, I think that we continue to do that, but I did want to kind of put that out there as something that we can be aware of and we can call attention to, if there's ways to tell the story without exploiting individuals and their
yes.
circumstances.
No, so, that is absolutely true. And I do know that from my experience working with people with substance abuse. There are ways to sell it and to sell the programs and to get more funding without using the people.
So last time we got an update on the intervention effort. It was as they're moving into the newest phase of Operation Rio Grande. They didn't have the beds online yet for access, so it was a plan, and we were told that they were tweaking it away from what the Operation Diversion was to more targeted. That was several months ago. Maybe we should get an update on the success of how that has gone.
And how many beds are actually online right now?
Right.
Yeah. Did the beds become available? Are they being utilized? And what is the success rate? Because Chief Brown specifically had been said they were less than happy with, I guess, how Operation Diversion had worked with the success rate. So the targeted intervention, where it was going to be approached differently, was was supposed to be more successful. So maybe we should find out how has that intervention worked.
Well, and how are they measuring success?
Right. I think that's the question we need to drill on because what we did get the funding for the Medicaid extension, the waiver was approved. So a lot of the beds that you see with Odyssey House that they opened and that they were able to fill, that was done through the Medicaid waiver funding. The challenge is, and if you talk to caseworkers that are working with individuals to determine their eligibility, is a number of people that come to ask to be part of those placements still don't qualify for one reason or another. The thing that seems to be the most problematic is, and that's why they made some changes with the next waiver that they're asking for to allow for a work requirement. We can spend a lot of time about the pros and cons in that and how most of us don't agree that there should be a work requirement. But for some of the individuals that were coming to apply for eligibility, if they had even taken odd jobs on to try to get themselves by, that was a strike against them for qualifying for getting enrolled, because there are certain provisions that say you're not supposed to be employed. I mean, you're supposed to be destitute. So it really kind of, there were a number of individuals that should have qualified that needed the treatment that couldn't qualify. And so now they're trying to work that through, but the quick solution that it was supposed to be 2 years ago when we passed that piece of legislation is still not optimal. And so I think we also need to kind of keep the fire under both the county and the state as to, you know,
right.
I think an update on that, Jason, is a really great idea, especially now that we've had 3 or 4 months since the waiver was approved to see how many people are being placed. Are they staying with treatment? What are the challenges that they're running into?
And what is their definition of success?
Yeah.
Because success with substance abuse is
long-term.
Is just an amorphous sort of thing. Do you measure it by they're clean this month, they're clean 6 months, a year?
The state is looking at it as if we get job placements for them.
And that's, I don't know that that's necessarily success.
Get jobs for them?
Yeah. I mean, that's their trajectory.
They will all get jobs.
The trajectory is they have their three-tiered plan. The first is we cleaned up the criminal element, got them out. We put people in treatment, and then we find them. Jobs with dignity is what it's called.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's boom, boom, boom. And once they have the job, they're good.
And probably not now, but in 2 to 3 months, we might want to put on the calendar an update on the status for the shelters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we do need an update on the status of the shelters, and that's not something I was able to get to with Mr. Litt back when we were talking.
Bless you.
I mean, the initial plan, the way it was laid out, seems incredibly ambitious, and it seems like it's hit nothing but roadblocks. Mm-hmm. So just let them come and reassure us that that if the shelters aren't up and ready by the perceived time, that the road home and all of the other stuff will the schedule for their shutdown will be adjusted accordingly. Because we don't want to end up having a year and a half floating period where one is ramping down and the others aren't ready to be ramped up.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry, did we interrupt your presentation?
No,
yeah,
right.
you had more points you wanted to get to.
Anything else on that? Because that's a big one for me personally.
And we can bring, for our process, for the two that we're in charge of, we don't really know about the county one that's happening, but I can bring updates for that on what the timeline is right now.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't need to be anything in detail, just know if it's on schedule and meeting the benchmarks that it was supposed to meet, because the way we understand the plan is Road Home is supposed to be shut down after those are available. But it just seems like there's been quite a few roadblocks that are going to push the schedule back.
And make sure we're going to have the case management too that was discussed, because that's going to be critical in working with these populations.
Right. And then we can gather that information because the county is the one that's supposed to be programming that piece. So I'll bring as much information that we have, and then whatever Jen and
I wonder if it'd be helpful if we collaborated with the counties, with our counterpart with the county. That might
be
helpful.
I think is there.
I think it is, yeah.
We could,
yeah.
I don't know if that's happening. I can ask Emma how we can work with them.
That'd be a great idea.
Because it is
not even like in a formal setting, maybe just an informal meeting that might be helpful so we can actually coordinate efforts.
Oh, that's an excellent idea.
Yeah.
I know Z at the county, her last name is like past my head right now, but Z, she's working on getting a collaboration effort on that with CODA and like getting volunteers. I don't know where they are in terms of, because they're supposed to be like youth city and service sort of done on that, on the volunteer side, and some MOUs or RFPs completed. So we can double check with Z. And I think, yeah, definitely collaboration would be the way to go about.
Yeah.
And with Emma, just to make sure, if you want to contact anybody on their commission, we'll just get a list. Yeah. And then share that.
Actually, I think it would be a great idea if maybe once a year we did have a joint committee commission meeting with them.
I mean, we serve a very
similar population, right?
Yeah.
Theirs is very active.
Yeah.
CODA is very active. Yeah. They're the ones that are running, they're running like seminars, and I think they're doing the race. Yeah, and they have the MLK, so.
Yeah, and especially as we go through this whole census thing in particular, again, if we can avoid reinventing or duplicating efforts, is what I want to do. Wherever we can dovetail, we can collaborate, we're not duplicating efforts.
Yeah.
And then I'll try to also, I've not been as attentive and as I've had in the past with the state's multicultural commission. Again, I think another overlay, they're focusing on some other efforts presently, but And what I'll do is just put on myself on a future agenda to kind of bring up to speed about what they're doing. It's not any of this stuff currently. So
awesome. Other stuff that I discussed. I'm sorry. Any other discussion about homelessness? People experiencing homelessness. Okay. Some of the other issues, and to kind of speed it up because we were running low on time, I believe Sandra Hollins is working with various community leaders on some of the police violence that's been going on. And I don't recall who on our commission is going to be working on that, the police violence issue.
I offered.
Did you offer to do that? So Sandra Hollins is working with various members of the black community, and it may be helpful to collaborate with them.
Is this through CAG?
Yes, yes.
I've been with the Facebook group and interacting.
Wonderful.
Minimally, but...
Well, Sandra's fantastic.
I know Sandra.
She's a wonderful person, and it would be helpful to make sure that we are collaborating with them. So you are already working on that. So well done.
A little bit,
it's in
not much.
Jason's able hands there. And we could even invite Sandra to come in and talk to us about some of those efforts and what we can do as a commission to help further those efforts and support those efforts so that it has maybe some more legitimacy and not just them on their own doing it. So and
they met. They met with the mayor in January in a whole meeting with African American community leaders. So we have been talking about crossover, but haven't been able to. So I'm glad you brought that up. And if there is, that would be great to support in some type of way. And I have like the list of all those who had come. So if we are going to meet with them. And then it kind of dovetailed into the school-to-prison pipeline work.
Yes, and that's what I was going to mention next is the school-to-prison pipeline. That was something that's been on my radar for quite some time, and the mayor brought it up, and I was happy she brought it up because we got sidetracked by a couple of other things. But I'm not sure what we can do aside from the power of persuasion with the Salt Lake City School District to make some changes and to maybe implement some changes. And with this next election cycle, we may have more open ears for that, depending on how it goes. So it may be something that we wait for November before we start putting some pressure on them.
Maybe we can have Jennifer come and do a present. Jennifer Mayor Glenn come and do a presentation.
Oh, yeah. We can reach
as we get into a little bit, maybe like October or November.
Right.
What's next steps in regards to if we have new board members, what can we do to help facilitate that?
There are going to be some changes there. And
I believe former Commissioner Fernando Rivera had been working on the school to prison pipeline for about a year and a half. So he might have some materials on the subject.
Oh, that would be great. helpful, yeah. And in full candor to the commission, my brother is running for the Salt Lake City School Board. I don't know if you would think that would be a conflict for me to work on that or not. And I'm happy to stay away from it if he's elected.
I think if he's elected, I don't see a problem as long as you disclose it, but right. I'll let the other commissioners weigh on what our practice has been in the past.
Yeah.
My name is very clearly Nicole Salazar, and it's
the other piece that we can have is our senior advisor for education, Angela Doan, can come and discuss what are the initiatives that she's taking on. Mm-hmm. And she has a group of people that she's working with as well, but Angela and I have been talking about this needs to be an overlap with our Human Rights Commission.
I agree.
And then with our ADA committee, there's a couple of representatives from the school, not the school board, but from Salt Lake City School that work with students because they're also disproportionately impacted as well.
Right.
And I think the mayor said, even in that meeting with African American community leaders, this is one of the biggest things that she would like in terms of human rights to be addressed.
Okay. And can I ask, the mayor had that conversation with the African American community. Was the African community involved?
It was mostly the African American community. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, because their issues are different.
Yes. Oh, yeah, very much so.
And another question I have along the lines of the prison to pipeline topic, and you mentioned, you know, how, I guess my question is, what influence can we actually have for the Salt Lake City School District along those lines? I am interested to know what they're doing along those lines, including, and I'll throw this out again as I sound like a broken record, diversity training for the staff and educators in the school district.
So two things that I think we would be helpful to get an update on is Sandra Hollins, in her role with her hat of as a representative, has run legislation in the past in terms of training and work with school resource officers and was working with the school districts to try to figure out some type of plan. I don't know what the status of that is, so maybe we could reach out to Sandra to find out where that ended up at. But I know that, and then this year she ran a resolution related to restorative justice in the school districts. So that is an area of interest, policy interest for her, separate from her work here at the city. And so she may be able to weigh in just in terms of what she sees as next steps, because when she first started running the school to prison pipeline resolution and work and asking for the school resource officers to be trained and, you know, have certain expectations of them and how teachers shouldn't automatically be calling on those school resource officers to deal with disciplinary problems like they often are in some of our schools. That was the thing that she was starting to target. Got a little bit of pushback from the educators. It might be interesting. I don't know what the status of that is. I know what the challenges she was running into last year, but I know she's been working with a working group. So I think that it would be good to kind of get, again, a status report of where that is and how we can help. Because I think that's the how that we can help piece that you're asking about. I think she might be able to feed us as some ideas as to what that looks like. And I think, maybe it's a discussion with Chief Brown of, you know, when you're working with your school resource officers, have you trained them of a teacher asks them to intervene that they know that they have to do A, B, and C first before they do that? Or are they just automatically responding to those teachers? I don't know. I don't know what's happening in the schools.
And what is helpful? I'm sorry. I did not recognize you. I'm so sorry. What is your name? Luna Bunari, welcome, Luna. She is a member from the public and possibly interested in joining the Human Rights Commission.
Wonderful.
Nice. So I just wanted to add my personal experience and information regarding the prison to prison pipeline. All the district teachers are supposed to go through diversity training.
Okay.
It is part of the Salt Lake District's policy. Now, that training might be 20 minutes or 3 hours.
Oh, man.
That is something that we
get some consistency.
Number two, ACLU resolved a case with West High, in which they came up on this memorandum of understanding. And I think there is room to go over that, the suggestions that ACLU made and to see if the schools are complying. Because at West this year, there have been at least 3 or 4 incidences with the SRO's videos going viral of kids being manhandled.
Yeah, and there
was one more point. If I had written it down, sorry. Let me just stay with these two and the third
one. If you pop up with that, just set it.
Say
that's
it. Fine. No, that's good.
Thanks, Anna.
Another one.
Well, and I think what's helpful, and this is a little bit off, but the changes to the JJS statutes, that's also been very helpful, that kids aren't just being tossed in front of a juvenile court judge and given a record that everyone says can't be used against them in the future, but inevitably is. On every pre-sentence investigation report, those juvenile records come up. Mm. And it is a little ridiculous that kids are being held to that. Some as young as 10 years old.
Oh, my God.
I mean really.
Along the same.
The Salt Lake District has hired a chief diversity officer.
Right, yes.
They did. Well, they can hire a diversity officer, but if they don't train everyone who's working with the children, it's a title and it's a...
It's a dog and pony show.
Absolutely. And this is one area that I've been... Whatever volunteer work I do, I've been pushing for this.
Fantastic.
So I know exactly where diversity trainings are happening and where they're not happening and where they're useful and where
they're
not.
That's great. Well, then
just having them, you know, getting them to have an officer itself is a...
Sure.
Well, then we would love to have you on the commission. So please.
Thank you.
Please, please, please. We would love to have your input on that because that's great.
That's this meeting.
Something else to keep in mind. My understanding is records kept by things like Metro Gang Task Force carry over from juvenile to adulthood.
They do indeed.
That's something that.
Yes.
So one of the one of the things that the mayor has emphasized is that she would like us to try to come up with actionable items, implementable recommendations.
Yeah.
So while we gather lots of information,
as a recommendation.
Yeah, as we gather information, we need to kind of keep in the back of our heads, what can we do with this information to recommend to the city and the mayor's office of things that can change? And
something
that might
be
something.
Something we can do is we could recommend a change to the ordinance as how those records are classified. And this is maybe more of my me thinking legally and what can be used in court against somebody. But when a record is classified or is classified as safeguarded or protected, it makes it a lot harder to get to. Mm-hmm. And if the definition of that record is changed such that it can't be used later, that may be a way to do it if we change the ordinance and how at least Salt Lake City Police can use that information.
Yeah.
If we're talking about Unified's gang task force, we're looking at more of a countywide ordinance that we'd have to kind of massage through the county system, you know.
Right, and what we know now with we used to be part of that the task force gang prevention, whatever they were called at that time, but now Salt Lake City branched off of that because they had some.
It was a funding issue, and my cousin was a lieutenant of the gang unit for a lot of years.
And they were highly concentrated in other areas in Salt Lake City, so we can also bring them in. I think this is great for a future, we can bring in, Jenny, Sandra, and Angela all into one meeting, and then it's great because then we can have these discussions as well, so all of their perspectives and overlapping things.
Yeah.
I think that would be very interesting HRC meeting.
Fantastic. Is there a way we can set a timeline or an attempted,
Do you want me to get them for, a September or October meeting?
That's out a ways, but we also have...
Earlier than that?
Probably earlier than that.
Earlier, maybe summer thinking, so that we can we can have some actionable items to work on before the election.
Could we try for June? Hope for June, shoot for July?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then what I'll do is I'll send that out now so then I can coordinate all of them here at one time.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can't get all of them here for June, then I'll be like, can you come July? I hope you're not on vacation that first week.
Oh, yeah, that does. Oh, yeah, I forgot about the whole vacation thing because we have trips planned all over the place.
First week of June also is Pride. So I don't imagine that anybody from the city is going to be readily available on that week.
Let me see that real quick.
There's also another event over here that parking becomes an issue, I believe, the Arts Festival, and then this Craft Lake City in itself. Yeah. So there's a lot of events that happens. Unless you guys want to have an off-site meeting, we can.
Yeah, we can organize that.
Right. The other thing I was going to mention, since we're talking about timeline, is Human Rights Day, as well as setting up an all-year-round timeline. So Human Rights Day is usually the second Saturday of the month.
And we've already reserved the Sorensen.
Tentatively,
if you guys all agreed, the Sorensen Unity Center, so that we do have a place early on. So we already reserved that.
So maybe like after, I don't know, the next meeting, if we have Representative Sandra Hollins and Angela Romero and one other person.
Angela Dome,
To talk about these, education, these items, and then maybe one of the agenda items can be about planning out the year and who's working on what.
That's a good idea.
Because we, remember we had the diversity recruitment that Martin had, Martin Buba, who stepped down, as well as language access, what else, gender and equity. Anyways, we have the five priorities that we that you guys have come up with.
But I think that because this is a whole new group, I think that would be a really good conversation to
also review. Yes, to revisit.
I don't know if we have the same energy or...
Right.
And especially with the conversation you brought up with the urgency for the census, that I think we can have impact on that immediately.
Right, and just kind of reviewing the needs.
I'm just saying in suggesting we have that conversation again so that if it is something you want to talk about, not just saying we have to stick with these five things.
Until we fill the five vacancies, I don't know if we're going to have enough people to be able to cover all of the priorities that we've laid.
So I have one good news on that. I have a refugee individual that is interested. He works at Catholic Community Services.
Could
fill in the at-large position. His name is Wassam. Or is it district? I'll have to double check on exactly what district, but he is,
And then District 6 is... we still have the two. I think he was District 4. And then the District 6 is, I don't know if you know, Kim Maines. She's from the LGBTQ community.
Oh, cool.
And she's already been interviewed. We're just waiting on the
perfect.
So she's in the pipeline to already.
Right. Okay.
And I contacted your friend, but I haven't heard.
So my friend, she sent me a text message. She thinks Luna would be a better fit.
Oh.
Which is why Luna is here.
So she nominated someone
else. She's nominating Luna.
What about Luna?
Right, yeah.
So. Yeah, and so then I was like, oh, I don't know. I just wanted to make sure because I contacted
And I meant to tell you, I meant to email you, but again, it's been,
crazy
busy. So, yes, so she thinks Luna would be a better fit.
So we have three.
And Luna, we keep getting, you're just...
The stars are aligning.
The stars are aligning, and you came today.
And I do want to mention that I am the Leadership Utah candidate from this committee as well.
Nice.
So I feel like I need to come back and...
We would love to have you.
But I am District 6.
Okay.
And you're District 6.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but we have two at-large as well.
Yeah.
Even though that's placed, we can fill in other positions. Mm-hmm. All right.
And also the ordinance, I think, is broad enough that... the mayor can add people as she sees fit to add diversity to the commission as well.
I am in the market looking for a house, too, so if I could be at large, that would be much better.
That would be perfect. Perfect. Okay. And the final thing was justice courts have been an issue. Salt Lake City justice courts have been an issue for me for a long time. I worked as a public defender in law school, and I noticed how... marginalized populations are adversely affected in our justice courts. The fine structure, the type of crimes that go through there, if more often than not, if a prosecutor doesn't want to have a jury trial, they just drop it down to an infraction so that it's tried in front of a judge and they can get a fine. And
it's on their record.
And it's on their record, and it stands in their way of getting jobs that pay well, and it's very frustrating. It ends up making life a lot more difficult for people who don't need to have life that difficult. So we did talk about what we can do there, and I've talked to some of my LDA friends about that. The nice thing is that Clem Landau was appointed to take over for, I believe it was Judge Shauna Graves Robertson, I think. I'll have to double check my names on that one. I did recommend him to the mayor. I know I went to law school with him. The other one that was interviewing that I was really happy about was Jesse Nix. Mm-hmm. And I thought either of them would be an excellent fit because they both have a different perspective on how a justice court should be run, and it's not so much punitive. It's really let's just have this city run smoothly and not, you know, I mean, so many of those justice court judges treat a speeding ticket like it's a federal offense and that you committed a capital crime. I mean, as a bit of a speed demon, I've been in there going, are you serious? Like, I was going 10 miles over the speed limit on 7th. I haven't killed anybody. Why are you treating me like this? So, and that's me as a relatively educated and affluent person walking in there. I can't imagine what it's like for someone who's already marginalized and already feeling like their voice is not being heard. So again, that's with the city justice courts, there are some things we can do because it is under city control, but that's going to be more of a brainstorming of what can we actually do, what actionable items can we get out of that to make those justice courts less punitive and maybe implement more a different fine structure, because that is something that the city can do, is they can implement a different fine structure and offer community service more often than they do. But we are going to run into the inherent problem that justice courts are funded by the fines that they get. So something that I have...
It's a perverse incentive for them to...
It is,
how they process,
but
they operate.
Something that has worked in other cities, and I'd have to check my source on this, and it was probably something I heard on NPR, was fine structure that's based on your income. Mm-hmm. So that if you make $200,000 a year, your fine is $1,000 for speeding. If you make $800 a month, your fine is community service.
Right.
You know, something...
Well, I think that Brian King ran a bill this year. What was that on? Something similar.
He probably heard the same NPR story I did.
Yes, I've heard it.
Okay, so I'm not crazy. It was a good source. It wasn't like Washington Post.
He ran a community find something. Let me see if I can.
I've heard it's effective, and I remember it being from a reputable source that it was very effective. And truth be told, a large fine would make me go, yeah, maybe I shouldn't speed, because when I'm hit with a $90 fine, I just head out of the courtroom and pay it, and I'm out the door. And it's done. It doesn't hit my pocketbook that hard. I mean, it makes me go, well, crap, we can't go out for sushi this month, or I can't get those cute pair of shoes at Nordstrom that I was looking at. But for someone who's working minimum wage and supporting a family...
Oh, that's huge.
That is,
we come across it a lot.
That is just ridiculous. $90 is a lot of money, and that can't...
That's a choice of what they're
food,
eating.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not like me with my shoes. It's that are just cute. Not even like I need them. I just think they're cute and it'd go really well with my suit. And, you know, it's their life. Do I pay rent or do I pay this fine? And that's not a choice anyone should ever have to make.
No, when I did my term of service with AmeriCorps, I had to go 2 months without a headlight because I couldn't afford the $15 to replace the bulb and the headlight.
Well, yeah, right. And even in college when I was in my beans and rice days and tuna, man, I don't miss
those
days.
Here it is. Compensatory service in lieu of fine amendments, HB 248.
Compensatory service. So you're talking community service instead of...
This bill allows a defendant the option of performing compensatory service in lieu of a fine for a conviction of an infraction or misdemeanor.
See, and that is something that we could implement on the city level with the council. That's an ordinance, because the fine schedule is by ordinance. So we could...
Sure that passed,
we could absolutely do that.
And there's been so many cases where they've been brought...
It was signed. It's enrolled and signed by the governor.
So see, we could do the same thing on the city level with our justice courts.
Excellent.
Well, and as a community liaison, I took care of a lot of tickets, and sometimes I think to myself, why do we do this to people? And even at here our hands are tied because you can't tell a person, well, I'll just wave the wand and you can.
But for you.
Yeah, but so that would be great if it's changed on that level, because
HB 248, if you want to look at the language.
It's existed in the past, and I know this because I've translated for a refugee, and this has been a very long time ago, and they were living in Salt Lake City limits, and it was over something, had a court date, and
She was given community service. So
that's case-by-case basis, though.
Okay,
so. Yeah, so it depends on the judge you have and the prosecutor. Some will take pity on you. Some will just be on
I've never heard a case, and I've been here for 2 years. Every time they've told them they had to pay it.
Well, this was 15 years
ago. Oh,
yes,
long time ago. In these 2 years, and I'm like, why?
It's been paid, unfair.
And
it was unfair.
I think part of it, quite frankly, was the charm of me speaking it.
No, it probably was. Having someone, and that's the thing, is having an effective advocate. And I'm not saying LDAs does a bad job. I think they do absolutely the best they can with what they're given, and I have nothing but respect for them. And I am biased because I have a lot of friends who are LDAs. So I will say that disclosure. I have a lot of friends who are LDAs, so I do think they're amazing, and others may disagree. But that does help, having someone standing there with them, because for an infraction, you don't have a right to an attorney.
It is easy to do.
Yeah, so...
Which is there.
So it was passed.
It was passed, signed by the governor. That's what I'm saying.
Enrolled.
Just take
this language and put it into the ordinance. And that can come out of the commission
to
have a recommendation.
Here, understand that.
I would be happy to take that on because I speak legalese.
Yay, we could do that.
Okay, so me do this.
Finally, we can accomplish something.
You know what? You gotta celebrate what you
have. We actually have a quorum 2 months in a row, and we can do something.
We can do that. We got this. Well, chair election procedure. Oh, boy.
Okay, so I put that on there just because from our the ordinance as it stands, it just says that each city board shall select one of its members as chair and another member as vice chair who shall perform the duties of the chair during the absence or disability of the chair. That's all it says. So I wanted to bring that up just because then it would be the point of contact, and this is everybody who's currently on the board, and we're finally together. So
four of us.
Yeah.
All four of us. I'm glad we were all here. So.
Yep.
Yeah, yes.
Like
yay. This is a good start.
Short straw.
Let's be positive about this.
Okay.
We're all four of us are here, and we have hopefully a fifth coming on board.
And a sixth. So there's people on the pipeline.
We have new people. Come on.
Well, and that's kind of what I'm...
The process of getting people on, we need to figure out how long it takes, because we've been waiting on one individual to get sworn into by the council, and that's been a while.
So can I make a recommendation then that we have just a rotating chair where we go through sequential order?
All of you? That's all on you? Four.
I like that
that's
idea.
That's a good
idea.
I second
until,
that motion.
At least until we get some more people on board.
Okay.
I mean, once we get a full slate,
We don't know what other ideas are out there and what kind of energetic people are out there.
Yeah, maybe the new folks that come on board will be really excited about. Mm-hmm. I know that I would not.
And I would hate to miss out on someone else taking over leadership.
Yes.
Luna.
Luna, yes. Shauna.
Well, somebody's chomping at the bit to do this.
Kim.
I know that I am not interested in that. So.
I think my term is up in July.
Yeah,
so.
I know.
So. You can re-up.
You can
right?
renew.
Yeah.
You are the only male here.
So maybe, yeah.
No, we'll see. I haven't seen, I don't think the mayor's renewed anybody yet, so it may just be she wants to have people having 2-year terms. But anyway, we'll see.
I would love to see you come back in July, after July.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So at this point, then, maybe at the end of each meeting, we determine who's going to be the next chair for the coming meeting. I did it last month, so
I
you did
it
this month.
I took it for the team.
That's
so
one of you two.
I kind of gave it to you.
That's fine. I took it for the team. I'm good.
Have you had a chance yet?
It would be fantastic if you'd like to.
Okay, I'll do it in May, and then we have Sean do it in June.
May for...
And in that case, as a vice chair, you can have everybody be a vice chair, and we'll be fine.
We're small enough.
If we have to have
draw
one,
out of a hat, that's what I want to start doing. That'll be it.
Perfect. Okay.
A very horizontal.
That's going to say we're very clear.
Yeah.
We don't believe in hierarchy.
There's no boss.
Okay, so
that would be May 1st, right?
Right.
May 1st.
When I was managing Ross's campaign campaign, one of the things that was so shocking was, like, no, we should be egalitarian here. Everybody gets paid the same amount on the staff.
But which is nothing.
I was, yeah. I was, as a campaign manager, I shouldn't get paid more than the rest of my staff. It's right, just right. Everybody gets paid the same because we're all working hard. We're just doing different jobs.
See, I at least would have paid you in cookies, Girl Scout cookies. I mean, that's usually what my pay is for people in Girl Scout cookies. Okay, but the chair election procedure kind of stayed for the moment, rotating until we can find, until we get more people. Mm-hmm. I guess open dialogue is the next. Anything want to mention? Anyone want to mention anything that's on their minds?
I say the youth-led student protest was quite remarkable. We had local children organized and orchestrated march up to the Capitol, and
yep.
Awesome. There was also a counter-protest of people that occupied the same space. Both sides presented their claims, and there was... no conflict between the two
that's
sides.
That's what we were happy about.
Yeah, that was
very
good.
So it's definitely civic engagement and people using their First Amendment rights to express themselves, and I thought it was something we should all be proud of.
Absolutely, and I think also a lot of the schools that allowed their students to walk out was very heartening for me.
You know, absolutely, I agree, you know. My youngest attends Highland High School, and Highland was very proactive in sending a letter out to parents saying that they fully supported the walkout.
Yeah,
their request was, of course, that they return to class on a timely basis, and it's not a walkout and I'm going to go grab a drink.
Yeah.
And the students did, and they were really respectful.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It went very well, and I know a lot of students that organized a lot. Yeah.
Right. At Cosgrove, Principal Hunt actually led the walkout with the older grades, the 6th, 7th, and 8th grades, and so that was very nice to hear that. And of course, Father Andrew joined them in their protest, so that was very nice to hear that even the administration was joining in with this protest.
In the planning, educators were asked to wear red and follow behind, so it was clear that it wasn't being led by us teachers. It was being done by the students.
I don't know that it mattered in Catholic schools. they can throw that to the wind.
I'm sure. I just point out this was definitely a student-led, student-planned, student-run. It was the consent of the administration, faculty, or the schools was secondary to the,
right.
You know, it was nice that they participated, but it was very clear it wasn't the students being manipulated. It was it was all them, and we were asked to be behind.
I'd like to actually congratulate the mayor's team. I know at West High, during the walkout, they were registering for kids to vote.
Which
put, and I know my daughter did.
Good.
You know,
nice.
So that put such a positive spin off, you know, there were kids who were involved in organizing, and there were kids who, you know, sort of understood their power and channelized it by registering to vote and other activities. So I thought the mayor was amazing in taking that leadership role.
I thought so, too. I thought that was a very, very positive thing to do.
And behind
that.
The scenes, the amount of work to do the permitting process with the police, Angela Doan spent, the safety aspect. So the biggest part, we were so happy that none of the kids or anybody else in the were hurt or anything else, because that was the biggest.
It was well orchestrated.
It was well done. Because I couldn't get across the city. I had
that's
to be over. I was trying to get the avenues to Miss Thistle at 10 o'clock, and that was not happening the way I usually do it.
Did you go around the whole state?
Yeah, I did.
Kudos to Salt Lake City PD also for making everybody feel safe. They went well out of their way to let people know that even though there wasn't going to be a counter protest starting an hour earlier, that they would be safe to show up and participate.
Yep. Yeah, so well done, Chief Brown, in helping ensure that.
One thing I'd like to mention is I don't know if the other commissioners have heard about this, but there was a flyer, and they don't know the origin. It's been going around worldwide asking that today be recognized as Punish a Muslim Day, which
what?
Meant
do something to them.
Do something to a Muslim person.
I did hear
there's
about
like
that.
There's like 7 or 8 steps of things that you can do.
Right. I mean, including things such as throwing acid on people, pulling off women who wear hijab, pulling off their hijab, along those lines. I know the Muslim community here locally is at certainly at have been, and they're aware of it. Most,
is that today?
So it was supposed to start today, and it's to go on for a month of April, actually.
Are you serious?
Yes.
It's based out of UK?
It originated in UK.
I do know that.
I do know it originated in the UK. I didn't know there was one here.
But it's social media.
Yeah.
So it's spread.
Once it starts in one place, it goes around the world quickly.
So I know some states have police departments are issuing letters and meeting with community leaders, are patrolling masjids and like different shopping and business areas. And so I think we need to be proactive in that. And I'm waiting on our chief to see if he is willing to.
What is Chief Brown doing?
Yes. I have messages, so we're waiting on that.
Again, if he needs like a box of Girl Scout cookies to get this moving, mm-hmm. I have plenty at home because this is
I will follow up because I send that message. Sorry.
And along those lines, every single masjid in this valley, not just the city, but this valley, mm-hmm. has been targeted at one point or another.
And threats, yeah.
So,
mm-hmm. She lucked out. You got it.
Okay. It's horrible. I worry that when something like this, like an online meme or trend starts, that we draw more attention to it by pointing it out, and we inadvertently spread word of something terrible that otherwise wouldn't be noticed. Kind of the Tide Pod Challenge effect, I guess, for lack of a better term.
I'm also a part of, I am a Muslim, some part of our sort of networks where we were told specifically not to post anything about this because the Facebook algorithm and everything, once you post, it kind of gets more traction and everything. So a lot of kids and everybody actually know this locally and have tried not to post about it
everything.
And I think kids are much more aware than the adults at the moment because this was actually a kid-led campaign out of UK. Ugh. And some of the mosques have actually put out counter sort of suggestions saying, okay, look at a Muslim today and smile. Or, you know, give a Muslim a hug for every sort of point they were. But
I would say ask first.
Ask for the hug first. You don't want to commit any sexual battery because that is an offense in our criminal code. Just FYI, I can't advise anyone to give anyone a hug that does not have permission to do so.
With hugs?
Muslims put it out, so I'm sure.
They, okay.
Oh, okay.
When things like this come out, I mean, our Muslim women who wear hijab are big targets, as are Sikh men, because people don't know the difference.
They don't realize the difference between a Sikh turban and, that's...
So I will plan to send an email update regarding the letter from Chief Brown, as well as there is an event, which actually is Emerald. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Emerald. It used to be called the FISA Initiative. It was in regards to Islamophobia education. They're having a dialogue about Muslim men. I'm trying to remember the title. I'm sorry as I speak. Young men as a Muslim to talk about their realities and how a lot of people think is just women are oppressed in Islam. But so just to kind of fix some of that biases and things that are going on. So that would be on April 10th. So I think one other thing we can do as a commission or as a city is use this punishment thing that's going on and turn it into a positive action, like you said.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Get involved, do something. So I'll update you guys as soon as I get information.
A couple of handsome boys who are speaking there, including my son.
I was gonna say, is it one from your son? Son, husband, yeah, right. Brother.
On that note.
Okay,
one other announcement. Yes. I'm so sorry.
Go
I'm talking
it.
Too much today. Tomorrow night, so I've been hosting cultural nights, refugee cultural nights. Each month we highlight a different refugee community or country. And this month, tomorrow's, is going to be on the Rohingyan community in Utah. We have about 200 of Rohingyan, and currently there's a genocide that's happening. So the mayor is going to put out a press release. Actually, the press release has already been sent out. We'll try to forward that to you guys. Also, there's going to be an op-ed on the 12th in connection to the Holocaust and Passover.
Is that press release on our Facebook page, on the HRC Facebook page?
It's on the, I believe.
We just sent it out this morning,
so we can forward it
out.
Put it on
the Facebook page.
Okay, that's a good idea. Speaking of the Facebook page, we might need somebody. Usually commissioners, we can add all of you guys as admins or as editors on the page, so you can post and share topics and things that are relevant, things that are important to the community, events. So I'm leaving up to you guys. Whoever is interested, just
we'll just
it to
add
us.
Your name.
Yeah.
Yeah, I noticed I had admin access, and I went, oh, okay, cool.
Except like, we just gave you the consent.
We didn't need consent from me. Are you sure you want to give this to me? No, I'm fine. I'll be good.
Just one thing to add. I'm so
yes,
sorry.
Yes, please.
I know
no, open dialogue session.
So it's Ramadan starts on
yes,
May 15th this
it does.
Year.
Inshallah.
I am trying to get a group of Muslim parents to send out a letter to different district heads to speak about how to handle Muslim children during Ramadan and what kind of needs that they might have.
Right.
So sort of like a package which answers all the questions. If there's an athlete, a Muslim athlete,
right,
you know, what to do.
Right.
And stuff like that.
That would be good to go on the Facebook page, too. And, you know, I know last year there was a thing that I was kind of joking about it with my cousin and brother about taco trucks serving halal meat and parking outside of masjids. In the evening?
The evening during Ramadan?
Yeah, during Ramadan.
That's cash cow. That's like
right? Well, and not just like cash cow. Everyone loves tacos.
Yes.
But also just getting the two populations together.
Yes, that is bridging the worlds. I think that's...
Well, we do something similar with the Mormon, like MM. We call it MM Iftar. So we had a iftar with Mormon and Muslims to really bridge that gap and the differences that you have.
So I'm
that's actually
really
funny because I was joking with a friend of mine who was starting up a food truck, saying that during Ramadan he could park outside in front of the mosque before sunrise, and you could sell up your coffee in minutes.
Yeah. Well, and then after sundown, and make sure you have the actual sundown ready to go and sell then. But just make sure everything is halal. And your
set. University itself is a good place. There are a lot of Muslim students there.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Do not cook.
Khadija works well for me.
And the mosque always have food, like during Ramadan, even if you're not a Muslim and you just want to experience what it's like to fast, what type of food they eat. So it's all the mosque.
You know, and they all have iftars, so you can come and enjoy, and they're fantastic.
I have friends. Well, Shab. Shab was very sweet and cooked for us last year, and that was lovely. That was amazing. So that was fun. All right. And no one has anything else to say, is there a motion to close the session?
Motion to adjourn to our next scheduled meeting.
Second. Any discussion? No, all in favor?
Aye.
Motion carries. We are adjourned.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you, everyone.
This was the best meeting. Second forum.